Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we discuss why Black and Latinx people are catching and dying from COVID-19 at alarming rates, and hospitals are nearing capacity in the Valley. Doctors tell us what it's like for them. But first, the Fresno County Historical Society recently announced that its annual Civil War Revisited event won't be happening this year due to COVID-19. But as FM89's Laura Satsui reports, the Society is planning an event centered around telling more of the stories of the 19th century beyond the Civil War.
At its heart, the Fresno County Historical Society says the Civil War Revisited has been about connecting students in the San Joaquin Valley to history. Patrick Arena remembers going to the reenactment at the age of 10 with his school.
I went several times between age of maybe 10 to 25, but I mainly went with my dad.
The 34-year-old realtor grew up in Fresno, but now lives in Sacramento. When he first went to the reenactment, it reminded him of a campout.
It smelled like campfire. What I didn't know at the time was sulfur, and that was from the black powder rifles, actually, that they used from the reenactment.
He remembers his dad interacting with the reenactors, but not much discussion of the main reason the battles were fought.
The inclusion of slavery did not really stick out in my mind as something that was prevalent at these reenactments. I'm not saying it wasn't tried to be brought up, but as a kid and to my memory, I don't remember that kind of sticking out as an exhibit or something that was included.
It's not that the event hasn't discussed race at all. Last year, there was a talk with Harriet Tubman, the abolitionist. Broadly, however, Fresno State historian Ethan Keitel says Civil War reenactments have perpetuated a myth about why the war was fought, and in some instances, glossed over the Confederacy's goal to maintain slavery.
But where they fall short, I think, is they too often focus on what I would say is the minutiae and everyday experience at the cost of teaching larger lessons about the conflict as a whole, the social, the political, the cultural ramifications.
He says Fresno's Civil War Revisited, which began 30 years ago, is one of many reenactments created to commemorate the battles a century after they happened.
What can't be lost is that's part of a larger reconciliation project that also involved a lot of forgetting. Forgetting what the war was fought about, forgetting the racial divisions that existed before, during, and after the war.
Still, Keitel says many students tell him attending Civil War Revisited made them want to pursue history in college. A year ago, however, the Society and its new president, Elizabeth Laval, started to conceive a new event, one that better aligns with its mission of remembering the history of Fresno County.
And so we sat down with Fresno Unified's curriculum department and decided to make an expanded timeline that would include California-based and Fresno County-based events, as well as national events, which would be perhaps the Civil War in some form or another.
It's called Time Travelers 19th Century America. There will still be Civil War elements, but other stories too about immigrant communities that settled here, like Armenians, Italians, and Japanese.
I don't think there's ever been an event that highlighted the settling of the neighborhoods in Fresno. You hear about Chinatown, but what does that really mean? Who lived there? And you know, it wasn't always pretty. Even in our valley, there was discrimination that was strongly felt by a lot of these groups that came in. And we want to address that and also show the successes and contributions that they've made across the board.
Tara Lynn Gray is the CEO of the Fresno Metro Black Chamber of Commerce. She says it's exciting to see the society expand the event. Black history, she says, is American history.
And in order for the historical society to be inclusive, which I believe they want to be, then they have got to reach out and find a way to bring the right people to the table who can share that rich history.
Last year, the Chamber was a sponsor of Civil War Revisited, and Gray says it would be open to sponsoring the new iteration, Time Travelers, because it could shed light on stories that haven't been widely told.
It, most of the time, is uncomfortable for folks to listen to those stories, share those stories, and participate in the proliferation of those truths. And I think that it is the responsible thing to do.
While this year's Time Travelers event won't take place in person due to COVID-19, the Historical Society is writing an online curriculum that will begin to examine some of those stories, highlighting successes and uncomfortable truths. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Earlier this week, the New York Times published an analysis of national data that found that Blacks and Latinx Americans are three times as likely to catch COVID-19 compared to whites. To discuss the implications of those findings and what it means for the battle against the virus here in the Central Valley, I spoke with Whitney Pertle, Assistant Professor of Sociology at UC Merced, Dr. Tanya Pacheco-Warner with the Central Valley Health Policy Institute, and Chet Hewitt, President and CEO of the Sierra Health Foundation and the Center at Sierra Health, which is focused on ending health inequities in the San Joaquin Valley. So, Dr. Pacheco-Warner, I'd like to start with you. What are some of the factors that account for the data that we're seeing that Black and Latinx Americans are disproportionately more likely to catch COVID-19?
One of the things we have to remember is how much of our Latino Hispanic population is out on the front lines right now in high contact jobs. So food, retail, hospitality, healthcare related support. So really what we see is that the Latino population is out there in the community not being able to stay at home as much as possible, which makes social distancing very difficult. It's also important to think about how, when it comes to the vulnerable Latino population, that food insecurity, housing and rent insecurity that existed much before the pandemic makes it really difficult for people to make that choice to stay home and forgo a paycheck, even when it comes to the idea that maybe you should quarantine because you've been in contact with someone without the added support for them to be able to continue to support their family. That's a difficult decision to make.
Chet Hewitt, I'm wondering if you could speak to the same question as well, and maybe specific to the community that you serve and the conditions in the South Valley.
Well, I think my colleague is spot on. He talks about the kind of social and economic conditions which, you know, make it difficult for people to isolate and protect themselves and their families. Issues from, you know, being essential workers, dense working environments. You know, when you think about food packaging and food production, those are types of kind of economic activities that don't allow for social distancing. And then I would have to add into that housing, you know, more dense housing. Housing is very expensive in California, so it's hard to think about, you know, how do you practice good public health measures when the social conditions in which you're living out both your personal and economic life, you know, don't allow you to do the kind of social distancing and have the kind of health practices and the kind of spacing that's needed in order to be as protective as possible for your families and your community.
Whitney Pirtle, given what we know from health equity research, is this at all surprising?
No, it's actually not surprising for all of the reasons we just heard. This is a health crisis like many other, and all it does is exacerbate existing inequalities. And so in thinking about the last question about why we see Black and Latinx American disproportionately harmed, I would like to name specifically structural racism as a reinforcing inequitable system that shapes the precarious work that we've talked about, the residential segregation and exposure to environmental harms and close living conditions, even homelessness. Incarceration is another aspect, and we see that prisons are hotspots and who is more likely to be stopped and then arrested and charged. And even medical bias, so racism within our medical institutions and interpersonal racism. And research has shown that Black Americans, for instance, have been turned away more likely for showing symptoms of COVID-19 than others. And so I think it's those social economic conditions and racist conditions that we have in the United States and in the Valley that has definitely shaped the unequal harms that people of color have faced.
Dr. Pacheco Warner, can you speak to mortality rates? What do we know at this point about the relationship between mortality rates for Black and Latinx Americans related to COVID-19?
You know, in big cities around the country where there is a significant Black population, we are seeing a disproportionate burden of the deaths on the Black community. And so this is, again, as my colleague mentioned, so many of these things contribute to the disproportionate Black death rates in locally, though, from the data that we do have available, such as with Fresno County. We are seeing the disproportionate amount of deaths among the Latinx population. And again, and even across age groups too. So it's not even just our most elderly frail that are dying. And so that is for me a cause of alarm that we have disproportionate harm being done by this pandemic on the Latinx community. One thing I will say, though, locally for our Black American community is that we do not know yet if the Black community locally feels comfortable enough or is getting enough access to testing to really know if those numbers that they have are really reflecting what we're seeing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like when this conversation first started, when we were first seeing data that indicated that there may be a bigger issue in the Black and Latinx community, much of the conversation was related to the fact that those are populations that are more likely to have underlying conditions like diabetes or hypertension, which we know statistically is the case. But what I find interesting about this conversation is that it's so much more complicated than that. Whitney, I'm wondering if you could maybe elaborate a little bit more about the complexity of addressing these kind of disproportionate outcomes when it comes to health in America for people who are not white.
Yeah, I think we have seen a lot of that conversation. You know, if you have a pre-existing condition such as diabetes, maybe asthma, that you are more likely to catch and then die from COVID-19. And the research suggests that people of color, especially Black Americans, Indigenous populations, are more likely to have those pre-existing conditions. But I would say as a sociologist, we have to look at what puts people at risk for any of these outcomes. So if asthma puts people at risk for COVID-19, what puts those same people at risk for asthma? And we can trace that back to environmental racism, lack of clean water in particular areas. We see that in the Valley. We see that in Flint. We see that in all these places that are hard hit. Who can, you know, who has access to green spaces for social distancing but still wants to do exercise? And so I think if you're trying to sort of trace the causes, the social causes of COVID-19, you can't stop at these other pre-existing conditions that already are impacting and killing Black and Brown Americans, you have to find those root causes. The socioeconomic disadvantage and inequality we're seeing, structural racism, and address those things, those social conditions that put people at risk for additional risk.
So I'd like to shift the conversation and talk a bit about data itself and what is being reported and what is not being reported. So Chet, I'm going to throw this question to you. As we develop better strategies to prevent the spread of the coronavirus, why is it so important to have data that is disaggregated by race and ethnicity?
Well, the data is important because we need to know where to target our resources. And given the unusual circumstances under which this pandemic is playing itself out, in terms of there being limited levels of resources, from testing kits to PPE and other devices that we typically use, knowing where and how to deploy those interventions is incredibly, incredibly important. We know that for African Americans here in California, who are 6% of the population, they are actually underrepresented in a number of diagnosed cases at about 4.4%. We think that has a lot to do with the racism issues as it relates to who gets diagnosed, who gets access to care, who gets access to testing. And I think itself in mortality rate, because in that particular category, African Americans are about 9% of the total COVID-19 related deaths in the state of California. That is over two times their representation in diagnosed cases. And so that is a demonstration of a lack of access to care, the diagnosis and treatment ultimately that has the potential to save lives. And so having good data about where to target those limited resources is incredibly important. And the same is true for the Latino community, Latinx community as well. When you think about being 39% of California's population, about 52% diagnosed cases, and about 44% of those who actually die from COVID-19 as well. We need this data so that we can target the resources we do have to be most effective in preventing community transmission, treating those who are infected, and most importantly, trying to stave off death rates that are disproportionate to the representation within the total population. And for us as a health foundation, that's what equity looks like. And so we have to address all the things, both on the social, economic, and on the healthcare delivery side, in order to help keep populations safe.
Dr. Pacheco Warner, I'd like you to follow up on this. Where do you see holes in the data that's being reported by Central Valley counties?
One of the big challenges is that we have a big gap, a big proportion of our data is unknown when it comes to race and ethnicity. And so it's not being collected in a number of places where testing is being done. And that presents a challenge for us in terms of trying to figure out where the resources need to go. So, for example, we're working to secure CARES Act funding to go to quarantine support, but we would like to know really with those limited resources, where do they need to go? One of the other things that is a big gap right now is really understanding which ones of our Asian communities are being most impacted. We know we've heard stories in terms of, for example, the Punjabi community falling through the holes. But we don't know really in terms of when we see an Asian category, what that really means for our Valley communities in terms of where the need is right now.
Certainly, because you have a big portion of Southeast Asian population, of the Hmong population that are working in the fields, working in conditions where they might be more vulnerable or susceptible. And it seems like the data as it's being reported is not giving us a clear picture of the perhaps disproportionate impact on those vulnerable populations. Am I hearing that correctly?
Yes. And also, I would also say that the coupled with the lack of data in terms of industry and where the cases are popping up, in terms of what kinds of jobs people are being exposed to. Like we know from lots of anecdotal data, lots of intelligence on the ground,
that people are giving us, that, you know, packing houses and things of that nature are high risk. But we can't see it in the data as it stands right now, because it's just not being collected in a uniform way. And that's not necessarily on a local jurisdiction's responsibility, but really, what are the mandates in terms of the data that needs to be collected? And do people have enough resources on the local level to collect that data?
Whitney Pirtle, you know, you're a sociologist, you study health inequities. I'm wondering if you think there is anything we as a society will learn from this pandemic that may lead to better outcomes for minority communities moving forward, or do you think this is just maybe a repeat of the same patterns of behavior that have made these populations vulnerable in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do see it as a repeat of previous patterns of inequities that stem from living in an unequal society. And so as a sociologist who studies, you know, societies and structures, we always point to those larger things to make the changes that we want to see. So figuring out why things are unequal and trying to gain more equity. But I do hope that it is a learning moment for all of us, especially those in power. But just to think about the fact that this crisis is exacerbating things that we have already seen. How can we address those problems that we know about? How can we address bias in medical institutions? How can we address food insecurity? How can we make living conditions stronger for those on the front lines? How can we make sure that people have PPE in all aspects? You know, I think if I had to name one, the biggest takeaway I would want people to understand about this moment is how health equity crosses every single social problem that we have. So it's related to food and water and clean air and even climate change and education, right? We're seeing conversations about even mental health impacted from being removed to school. And so as we're moved forward in thinking about how to make societies better, I think health equity has to be a central part of that conversation.
Chet Hewitt, how can we better protect these populations? I mean, we're in this moment, I think there's a collective sort of scramble to address all of these many issues that have been raised in the course of this conversation. But knowing what we know now, what would you like to see communities and counties and states do to reduce this inequity?
Well, quickly, I want to go back to your last question and just say that I think the most important thing will be what we do about the conditions that are actually presenting themselves. You know, those of us who've worked on the social determinants of health have known for a long time that, you know, people's health status and their vulnerability can be deadly. And whether that's around asthma or diabetes rates or other issues, chronic diseases, we've known that for a long time. We know that poverty, particularly when it is promoted by or protected or traps people because of issues related to racism, that it is a deadly combination. And in this country, it's something that we need to fix. So issues around access to health care and access to affordable, quality housing, the ability to not be trapped in poor working conditions, the distribution of opportunity for folks are really important to the ongoing health status, particularly of those who are lower on the socioeconomic status scale. And so in the future, we need to realize that inequality and inequity and a lack of social justice is a health issue, and that is not only about the chronic diseases or morbidity that it promotes, there is mortality associated with it because poverty actually kills, shortens lives, and I think has a detrimental effect on the overall social and economic health of families, individuals, communities, and ultimately, you know, this state of California and this nation.
Well, I will throw the last question at Dr. Pacheco Warner. I'm just wondering what else you would like to contribute to this conversation in terms of what we do moving forward and what opportunity there is to address these inequities.
I think we are in such a pivotal moment right now in our country to be the most imaginative, the most bold in what we propose to do, because for us in our generation, this is unprecedented. And in our generation, we are seeing levels of unemployment that we haven't seen in a really long time. So I think about, for example, young people who are thinking about whether or not to continue their education and because of the moving to an online platform. And I think for me, this is the time for thinkers to emerge. This is a time for big proposals to emerge. And I can tell you, just from what I'm seeing locally, we are leveraging, about $15 million to go to things that we have been asking for a long time, like comprehensive childcare in our communities so that our essential workers can go to work and be rest assured that their kids are going to be taken care of safely and be protected from the virus. We are going to be integrating community health workers, which we've known for a long time are such a key partner to health in linguistically isolated and culturally isolated communities, to be hired as contact tracers, to be hired as people who are doing the outreach and support for people, helping them understand how to quarantine. And so really, I feel like this is a time to shift our thinking and really put forth and implement the things that we always have known work and see them be instilled, not just now in the emergency, but how institutions can continue to support them after the emergency ends. And this goes for so many of my colleagues that have moved leaps and bounds in terms of housing and rental protections that they've been fighting for years. Some of these things are now on the bridge of being made a reality. And I think that is where we need to focus our efforts, is really thinking system shifts and really just putting those proposals forward, because no one really had a strategy about how they were going to address this pandemic. So thinkers and doers coming together now, putting together those proposals, bringing them forward, now is the time to actually implement some of these things.
Well, I thank you all for your expertise and your leadership on this issue, and thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As the COVID-19 caseload climbs across the West, health officials are becoming increasingly concerned about surges and whether hospitals will have the capacity to handle them. Here to talk about how prepared local hospitals are and more is FM89's health reporter, Carrie Klein, with our weekly COVID-19 update. Thanks for being here, Carrie.
Hi, Kathleen.
So let's start the same way we always do. What's the COVID-19 outlook in the Valley this week?
Well, this is going to be similar to the last few weeks, but the new daily cases are still rising between 400 and 900 each day on average, and that's across our 7-county area, our coverage area here. At least 3 counties in this area hit records for the highest daily new case reports this week. In the last week, around 40 people have died of the virus, and our total count is around 22,000 cases. And where demographic data are available, the majority of those cases are among Latinos.
And why don't you give me some county highlights?
Okay, so just kind of looking briefly across the valley, in Madera County, last week I had mentioned that new cases had been increasing rapidly. Well, that county has now been added to the state watch list, where five other counties here in the valley had been. And that is due, that the fact that it was added to the list is because of spreading of cases during social gatherings, work exposure, and person-to-person transmission in large households. In Merced and Fresno counties this week, they both hit record high number of new daily cases on Monday and on Tuesday. In Tulare County, cases continue to shoot up, although the record high of daily new cases was actually last week, not this week. In Kern, there's an ongoing situation at Primex, the pistachio processing plant in Wasco. United Farm Workers, the farm worker union there, has reported that as many as 80 workers and 36 family members have been infected. And the county and the company are still kind of working on sharing information with the public about that. In Mariposa County, cases are staying low. There are only isolated case reports, and there's only one person currently hospitalized, and there are zero in the ICU, so that's good news. And in Kings County, correctional cases are now actually relatively under control. That's in state-run correctional facilities. The majority of cases are once again among the community outside of prison walls. However, deaths in Kings County due to COVID-19 nearly doubled in the last 2 weeks, and that's largely from an increase in fatalities in nursing homes.
Bill, thanks for the update, even though it's not particularly great news. Mm-hmm. So let's switch gears and talk about hospitals. How many COVID-19 patients are in local hospitals right now?
Okay, so according to state data across this coverage area, there are 579 COVID patients in hospitals compared to 347 2 weeks ago. So that's a jump of 66% in just 2 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, and this is a problem because more people are in the hospitals in general, not just with COVID-19. Many had been putting off care, staying away from hospitals and clinics, and they're now going back to be taking care of some of their health ailments. And so there are more people in beds in general in these facilities.
So given that situation, how close to capacity are hospitals in our area?
That's actually pretty hard to answer without actually talking with each hospital individually. And there are a lot in our area, or there are a lot everywhere. The state and counties provide some data about hospitalizations, but it's all kind of squishy. It requires a lot of context. And that's because a hospital might have a certain number of licensed beds, but not all beds might be suitable for COVID patients. Some might be able to be repurposed from other units, but some of them are strictly in ICUs. And even within ICUs, some are designated only for babies or kids, but can't be for the adults who are the overwhelming majority of hospitalized COVID patients. So if the hospitals that I've heard from this week say they're either at capacity or relatively close. And I focused on Kern Medical. Here's Russell Judd, the CEO of Kern Medical in Bakersfield.
We are at capacity, today, and that's pretty common. We do not have enough patient beds that are staffed by nurses to cover all the patients that need admitting. So we're holding patients in our emergency department while we're waiting for people to be discharged and we go through that cycle.
So Judd just brought up a really interesting point. Capacity isn't just a measure of beds, but of the people that staff them.
Yes, this is a huge point, and I think that's where the numbers fail. Judd says that Kern Medical is only using around 90% of its beds right now. I mean, that's still pretty high, but he considers them at capacity because they don't have the nurses for that last 10%.
Hospitals' license outlines how many beds they have and how many physical locations, but of course, it's only good if you've got the nurses and other caregivers to be able to care for the patient. So not only are we seeing the uptick in patients, but we're also seeing an uptick of the disease working through our workforce. So when you have a pandemic, not only do you have larger patients, but you potentially also have a sick workforce, and therefore you're hit on both sides.
However, Judd points out that not many of their nurses actually have caught COVID on the job. They're catching it out in the community if they do at all. And he says nurses specifically are the limiting factor because they're very specialized and deliver very attentive care. And fewer doctors are needed because they can generally bounce between patients.
So will Kern Medical be ready for a surge?
Judd seems pretty certain that they'll be ready. And that's partly because they'll be hiring what are essentially freelance nurses who bounce from medical center to medical center around the country.
Hospitals are inherently built to handle a fluctuation in census. That's basic, and every hospital does it. We do it on a regular basis. You hold patients here, you scramble, you call extra nurses in. So we're good at dealing with change and the dynamics of hospital census. And so I think the foundation is there. We are in discussions now to go out and secure nurses, additional staff, to begin the middle of August, the 1st of September.
So I said before that Kern Medical is at about 90% capacity now. Judd is hoping to hire enough staff and get provisional permits for more beds to get up to over 40% over capacity. So they're really planning to ramp up the space that they have. Other hospitals, too, are preparing in their own ways, finding ways to shuffle patients around and maximize space and staffing. And one example is St. Agnes Medical Center in Fresno. They've opened a designated respiratory center just for those very specialized patients.
Outside of the hospitals, some counties actually have surge sites that they're setting up, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Many counties have, they have different names. They're overflow sites or field hospitals, and they're lying at the ready. Some of them will take COVID patients. Some of them will take other patients so that the COVID patients can stay in hospitals. And, you know, some examples of that are the Fresno Convention Center lying in wait. There's the Porterville Development Center in Tulare County, and then there's the Mariposa Fairgrounds.
Well, Carrie, as always, thank you so much for the update.
Yeah, thank you.
But Carrie's not going anywhere. To continue our discussion of hospitals, we now turn to Community Regional Medical Center in Fresno, where Carrie spoke with a doctor we had on the show earlier this spring. Dr. Patil Armenian is an emergency room physician with a hospital at UCSF Fresno. And when she spoke with our news director, Alice Daniel, in April, she described the experience then as the calm before the storm. Now, 3 months later, Carrie asked Dr. Armenian if the storm feels any closer.
The storm has definitely hit. It took a while. Every week we were saying it's the calm before the storm. It's the calm before the storm. And now we are in July and it's definitely here and it doesn't show signs of abating anytime soon.
And so what is different now? I mean, what, obviously I'm sure there are lots of things, but in kind of broad strokes, what does feel different about the emergency room now?
Well, what feels different now is just that we're a lot busier. We have all of our regular patients. We have been the busiest trauma center in California for a few years now. And so we have all of our normal patient volume. But now on top of it, we are also seeing a lot of COVID cases, as are a lot of our sister hospitals in Fresno and the Central Valley.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about your regular patients. I mean, I know that, a couple months ago, I think in general, people were really avoiding hospitals and patient levels were down. Has that bounced back to the normal levels as people kind of continue to get their regular care?
I think that has bounced back to our regular levels, especially because, you know, people still need care for their heart attacks and car accidents and all of the usual things that happen. And so those have bounced back somewhat. And then now on top of it, we have a lot of COVID patients.
Right. And of course, there are lots of people who, you know, for various reasons, including access to insurance, you know, kind of use the emergency room as their chronic care center as well.
And that's true. But at the same time, it does seem like it's been hard for a lot of patients to see their primary care providers. And so we are, as always, a safety net for people who need help.
Right. Well, so when people come to the emergency room with COVID-19, or at least with symptoms, and maybe they get tested and are determined to have COVID-19, I mean, what does that look like for emergency physicians like you?
Well, first, when they initially come in, at least downtown at CRMC, they're separated out from patients who don't have any symptoms. And then we basically, you know, decide to test them or not test them, and then treat them accordingly. Everybody wears masks in the emergency department, no matter if you are a patient or a provider or a staff member. And we are actually implementing more telehealth. So sometimes we'll get on an iPad and do FaceTime with a patient so that we don't have to go in and out of rooms too often. And that is to conserve our PPE as well as to try to minimize contact as much as possible.
Wow. So even within your own emergency room or emergency department, you'll be FaceTiming with people just in another room.
We'll be FaceTiming with people in the tent outside. And then, you know, if we need to, we go into the tent. So it's not too often, but there are very straightforward cases that we are able to use telehealth for.
Very interesting. And then what are some of the complications that arise from COVID that could lead someone to go to the emergency room? Like, what are kind of some of the most common symptoms or complications that you're seeing?
Well, the most common symptoms that we're seeing are shortness of breath, cough, fever, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, diarrhea, really a lot of things. A lot of patients will come in because they feel short of breath. And so a lot of the most major complications that we are experiencing are respiratory distress and respiratory failure, which means they're just having such a hard time breathing that we need to help them to breathe better.
Right. And so then what about mental health? You know, is the landscape of mental health changing at all among patients coming to the emergency rooms? You know, especially you deal with toxicology that often includes, you know, substance abuse, overdoses. Are you seeing a change in the levels of those sorts of things as this pandemic drags on?
In the beginning, actually, we had no cases. I mean, there were no overdoses coming in. There were a few weeks where we were actually surprised. We were like, wow, nothing's happening. But now I would say we're just back to our normal numbers. So I don't necessarily see a rise, but just our usual frequency, which is a fair number. I mean, we do get a lot of methamphetamine complications. We get a lot of overdoses. And so those numbers are back to our kind of pre-COVID normal.
And so, you know, I think in some parts of the country, especially where there had already been surges and overflows of COVID patients, I know that treating them had been really traumatic for the doctors and the nurses and all the providers taking care of them. Do you feel like there's kind of a burden of trauma on the providers there at CRMC with you, or has that not necessarily quite hit yet?
I think it all, it just started getting a lot busier for all of us. And so we're not seeing that quite yet. But also at the same time, we are pretty well staffed. And so we have a lot of people on at any given time. So the burden isn't just on one team, for example. I think probably our intensive care unit teams are starting to feel the stress. But again, I think the work is right now spread across a lot of providers so that just one group doesn't get particularly burned out.
Well, that's good. I mean, do you or any of your other colleagues there, do you have any strategies for dealing with burnout or dealing with, you know, the really unique stresses of this particular time?
I think just in general, we're very fortunate to work in a place where we're a very close-knit group. We're really good at asking each other for help and giving each other breaks, you know, when someone needs it. So I think we just happen to already work in a pretty good environment. And so we're just continuing to rely on each other like we always have.
Do you get the impression that this level of, you know, this patient load that you're dealing with right now of COVID-19 patients, do you get the impression that this is going to be over anytime soon?
All of the data points to this not being over anytime soon. And in fact, I think that, you know, we had a rise in cases like a lot of areas in California because businesses opened back up, we opened back up, and people started to not wear masks as often. And so with the feeling that things were going back to normal, I think people in general started becoming more lax with mask wearing and social distancing. And we see the effects of that now. And we see that, you know, our cases are rising and we haven't really seen them fall yet. And I don't know at this point when they're going to fall. We'll just only time will tell. We'll just have to see.
And so that's when you would emphasize people really should take, you know, PPE, mask wearing, social distancing, take that into your own hands and do that yourself.
Yes. So people should definitely keep wearing masks whenever they're around anyone. Keep social distancing, minimum of 6 feet as much as possible. Even if you're going to just go visit a family member, we've seen so many cases that have just happened from family members visiting each other. And so really can't emphasize this, this topic enough.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Patil Armenian, thank you so much for speaking with me, and I hope you continue to stay safe.
You too. And everybody, please wear masks and keep social distancing.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Palliative care improves the quality of life for patients facing serious illnesses, and these days, that includes COVID-19. FM89's news director Alice Daniels spoke with the chief of palliative medicine at UCSF Fresno, Dr. Patrick McMillan, about what his work is like right now and how he uses music to cope with stress. She produced this audio postcard.
You know, I listen to a lot of meditation music and Anogamo, the CDs that I have from him, I listen to all the time, just as far as helping me to breathe and helping me to, you know, just kind of be mindful. Palliative care was made for moments like these where emotional, mental, spiritual, and obviously physical distress. Those things are all coming together at this moment in a very profound way, in a very, you know, traumatic way. And so I think how we intersect with this pandemic is we provide, you know, comfort in these particular times. We treat pain and symptom management. We try to treat the whole person and the family and all the kinds of ups and downs and emotional, mental, and spiritual distress that they might have. I was consulted in the ICU on a male patient, and the patient was dying and his organs were failing. And so I reached out to the family member, not having ever spoken to him, and it was the son, and just informed him that, you know, his father was dying. There's, you know, nothing we can do further. And as far as medically, that is, obviously I described what we do as palliative care and that we would keep him comfortable as he died. You know, what I found out, and it really struck me, and because I really not heard of these kind of cases, but this, I'm hearing more and more of these cases where, you know, the family members have actually given it to their parents. This was an actual son who contracted it at work. Where he works, and his whole family got infected, and so did his father. And his father ended up dying. Just the amount of, you know, sort of the emotional tension that he was carrying with him, and you could hear it on the phone. It was very palpable. I certainly got into medicine understanding that I would see death. And I'm in a specialty that we deal with death every day. So this is not something new to me. I mean, I've watched people die. I've tried to make someone's death without suffering. I've tried to ease suffering, you know, by giving, you know, medicines that help a person, you know, pain and so forth. But this is something different. And I think it's weighed on me more than I probably would like to acknowledge. I try to do a lot of things. I exercise, I meditate, I do a lot of things. You know, I interact with a lot of people and try to stay healthy as I can mentally and so forth and spiritually. But I felt this chest tightness thinking, you know, gosh, this is like a tsunami that's coming now. And it really panicked me. A lot of times when I exercise, I like to listen to rock and roll. This one band I came across recently, it was called Spoon, and this song, My Mathematical Mind, there's a lyric in there that says, I'd like to sing it for you, but I don't know if I could, but it says, I want to change your mind. And it's when I thought about that song, you know, it makes me think today. It's, you know, I really want to try to change people's minds, because there's so many folks out there that I think have been misinformed about the coronavirus and COVID-19. And I have a passion to help people, and I really want people to pay attention. I really want people to think about what they're doing and wear masks and social distance and not gather together. And so, you know, I listen to this music because it helps me unwind, because when I come home from work, I'm stressed, and even if I don't want to admit it, I am. I listen to this music, and it kind of takes me away for a while. So it's a nice, hopefully healthy escape. But I really want people to get the message that, you know, we're in this for the long haul, and, you know, there's not going to be a vaccine for another year for the general public, and we all have to get that wrapped around our minds in order for us to, you know, move beyond some of the problems that we're having right now. We have to make some sacrifices. So I'm hopeful that, you know, people, you know, will listen and open their minds.
Again, that was Dr. Patrick McMillan, Chief of Palliative Medicine at UCSF Fresno. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You could also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. And we'd love to hear from you, especially your experiences around the pandemic. Send us a voice memo on our app. Just hit the audience feedback icon and record. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, Carrie Klein, and Madi Bolaños. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.